Hi, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to this morning's class. I've been asked to begin on time, and I want to respect all of the other commitments that you've made. So we are going to get started. You will be able to find a source sheet on the course website on the Torah in Motion website. But if you do not, for whatever reason, have access to that source sheet, I will be sharing one today. And I'm always happy to email you a source sheet at the end of class if you email me at msimkovich@ctu.edu. I am also going to try to leave time at the end of this hour for questions and comments. Please note that I am not a rabbi, but thank you for your greeting. So I'm going to try to wrap up in about 40, 45 minutes. If you have questions or comments, feel free to put them in the chat. I will not see them until the end of the hour. So I would recommend that you hold off and type your question or comment towards the end of the hour, because I will not be reading the comments as I go. So today is one of my very favorite classes. I love to teach about novellas in the Second Temple period, novellas that are preserved in the Apocrypha. First of all, these texts are fun. And if you've had a chance to read some of them on your own time, they're very accessible. Online. You can go to any website that has a Catholic Bible and search up novellas that are preserved in the Apocrypha, like Judith, like the Greek version of Esther. Please, everybody, mute yourselves. Thank you. And so these are fun texts. There is adventure. There is separation of beloveds. There is crisis. There's always resolution. Before we get started on the particular novellas that I want to talk about today, I want to give a few overarching sort of big ideas, and then I'll share my screen. Before I do that, I'm going to open up my participants and I'm going to mute everybody. Okay. All right. Thank you for understanding. Okay. So, in the second century BCE, Jews are living all over the Hellenistic world. We've talked about this already. They're living in Judea. They're living in what's called the Western diaspora, all across the Mediterranean, North Africa, Italy, Rome, Antioch, all across the Levant, the Mediterranean lands. There are Jews. That's what's called the Western diaspora by some scholars. And there are Jews living in what's called the Eastern diaspora, Babylonia, which of course becomes Sasanian Persia, where Jews are speaking various dialects of Aramaic, and there are Jews in Judea. So there are Jews throughout this entire massive region of the Hellenistic world, and Jews are writing and writing and writing, and they're writing in various languages. In Judea, they're writing in Hebrew and Aramaic. In the Western diaspora, they're writing in Greek, and in the Eastern diaspora, they're writing in Aramaic. But there are certain common themes to Jewish writing at this time, which suggests that there is not a cultural binary between what language you speak and how you practice as a Jew, or what your worldview is, what your Jewish identity is. There is incredible fluidity between these cultures, and there are big ideas that appear in texts that were originally written in Greek or in Hebrew or in Aramaic. And if you look at novellas that were originally written in a diverse set of languages, mainly Greek and Hebrew, you'll see that common ideas begin to emerge. And so common ideas, but also common questions. And so these novellas address major themes and major questions for Jews living in the second century BCE. If you did not have a chance to look at my first two videos and watch them, I recommend that you go back to them, because today and over the next few classes in the series, we're going to keep going back to some things that we discussed in the first two classes. And so the novellas address big questions. What is the place of the Jew among Gentiles? What is the place of the Jewish people among Gentiles? How does God protect the Jewish people in this age without prophets and without explicit miracles? How does God protect the Jewish people regardless of where they live, whether they're in the diaspora or in Judea? How do we Jews know that the covenantal relationship between God and the Jewish people is living? And how can we pass that idea on to our children? And finally, we know what a Greek hero is. Even Hebrew-speaking Jews in Judea were familiar with Hellenistic ideas and Hellenistic stories. But what is a Jewish hero? And can we discern a difference between a Greek hero and a Jewish hero? What we're going to see, and we're not going to have time to go through this whole source sheet, it's a reference sheet for you, but we're going to see that many of the central figures in these Jewish stories, whether they're written in Hebrew or Greek, whether they're written in Judea or the diaspora, many of the central figures in these stories are women. And I'm going to put forth a thesis about why this is the case. And you might know some of these stories. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the story of Judith, of Yehudit, whose story is written in Hebrew in the second half of the second century BCE. I'm sure you're familiar with the story of Esther, maybe even in its Greek version, which is very different from its original Hebrew. But there are other heroines as well that we're going to encounter today. And I would like to posit a theory regarding why Jews in the second century BC and on through the rest of the Second Temple period are writing novellas, writing adventure tales that have women at their center. How could this be? So there are some theories. Tal Ilan, who is a very well-known scholar of the Second Temple period and writes a lot on women in the Jewish Hellenistic world, Tal Ilan makes a connection between these fictional women and very real historical women. The question of whether Judith is fictional or not, I could get to at the end of the hour, but Tal Ilan is reading these stories as fictional stories, and you could put that on the back burner, take it or leave it. But she makes a connection between these figures and women, female members of the Hasmonean family who occupy positions of power. Women such as Berenike, who's a Hasmonean princess in the first century, Salome Alexandra, who's the queen of Judea from 76 to 67 BCE, and many other very prominent female figures, Mariamne or Miriam, who's the wife of Herod and brutally murdered in the second half of the first century BCE. These are all Hasmonean princesses and queens. And Tal Ilan says that as Jews acclimated to this idea that Jewish women in Judea were occupying very real and substantive positions of power, they became comfortable with writing about women as representations of the Israel experience. Now, whether that's right or wrong, I want to layer something else onto it by looking back at the biblical text. And all Jews, if they were observant, whether they're reading their scriptural text in Greek or Hebrew, the Jews in the diaspora and Judea knew their scriptures. And they knew that the biblical prophets imagined the experience of Zion and of Judea in the form of a personified woman. And you can find this in Yeshayahu, the last 26 chapters of Yeshayahu, and you can find it in the Minor Prophets. And this is the theme that finds expression in many, many prophetic texts preserved in the Tanakh. And why is this the case? Why do the biblical prophets imagine the experience of Zion as an embodied woman? I think it's because when you look at the relationship between Israel and the foreign nations, and when you look at the relationship between Israel and God, you see that Israel has the weaker position. Israel is vulnerable, right? When it comes to God, and if you've read Yechezkel, the 16th chapter of Yechezkel, you see a very startling manifestation of this image of Israel as a woman. But in the marriage metaphors of Hosea, for instance, you'll also see this relationship of God and Israel being imagined as a marriage. Israel is weak. Israel needs God. Israel's vulnerable to God. And Israel's success depends on its acknowledgement of its dependency on God. In the ancient Near East, we're in a patriarchal society where this wasn't considered not PC or offensive. This was the social reality of the people. And so Israel, as a woman, makes a lot of sense. It also makes a lot of sense in terms of its relationship, not just with God, but with the foreign nations. Imagine Israel versus everybody else. Again, the minority, weak, vulnerable, dependent. And so when writers in the second century BCE are writing novellas that are stories about Israel's resilience and Israel's survival and Israel's inner strength as opposed to its physical strength, the best kind of figure to embody these challenges and these characteristics of resilience is a woman. And so when we look at Judith or we look at Esther, we see someone who has incredible inner strength devotion to their ancestral god, but comes from a position of physical weakness. And so it is my belief that thinking, whether you're a reader who is male or a reader who is female in the ancient world, thinking about the experiences of Israel as experiences of a woman is very resonant when you're thinking about Israel's unlikely survival. And so now we're going to look at some sources, and we're not going to get to all of these texts, but we're going to start with a text that I think is often deeply misunderstood and misread, if it's read at all. And that's the story of Judith, of Yehudi. And so now I'm going to share my source sheet. And I invite you to follow along if you have it in front of you. So I have a timeline. Again, we've gone over this timeline, but the reason why I include it here is because I changed it a little bit from the timelines that I've shared with you in earlier classes, because here I added some women so that you get a sense of a historical reality in which, especially in Judea, Hasmonean women are taking very public positions of I wouldn't say power, but certainly in the public eye. You have Berenike here, the great granddaughter of Herod is born. You have Queen Helena of Adiabene. I could talk about her if you're interested at the end of class. I think I have Salome Alexandra, very, very popular, at least among the Pharisees, Queen of Judea. And so I added some in so that you get a sense that these women were real and deeply, deeply admired among the Jewish people. We have a lot of information about some of these figures, particularly from Josephus. But I'm going to start with Judith. So many of us know the story of Judith because in the early medieval period, she's associated with the Hanukkah story. And that's not what I'm going to be talking about today. I'm not going to be associating her with Hanukkah in any way, because the story that we have about Judith as it survives from the second century BCE is a story that is not connected with the Hanukkah story, except, and this is very important, that it's written at a time, probably in the second half of the second century BCE. It's written in the early years of the Hasmonean period, which if you look at the timeline, you'll see, begins in 164 BCE and comes to an end in 63 BCE when the Roman general Pompey invades Jerusalem, and that's the end of the Hasmonean period. So Judith, the historical context of the Book of Judith is Hasmonean, and that's very, very important. And one of the things I'm going to suggest, and again, I know that there are people who would disagree with me, who would think that this is far-fetched, but it is my belief that Judith is a female embodiment of Judah Maccabee. They have the same name, Yehuda, Yehudit. They come from the same sort of historical milieu, although we'll look and we'll see that the Book of Judith is actually ahistorical. I'll explain in a few minutes what I mean by that. Judith is characterized by her finery, her beauty, her ornaments. Those are her weapons. She gets dressed, and we have paragraphs and paragraphs about the detail in which she ornaments herself to seduce the enemy general Holofernes. These are her feminine weapons. Compare that to the physical military prowess of Judah Maccabee and how he's described in the Book of 1 and 2 Maccabees. And I think what you have with Judith is a feminization of Judah Maccabee. And more than that, I think the story is a subversive story that subtly argues against the legitimacy of the Greek world. But what makes Judith so hard to understand is that there's really no historical information here that makes any sense at all. And we have to understand that the author in the opening verses of this work makes it very clear that he does not want the reader to read the story as historical. And we're gonna ask why would that be? And how then can we derive a message from the story if it is ahistorical? And so the story opens up. I don't have the whole, I only have 12 verses here, so I'm going to fill in a little bit. But the story opens up with a very, very strange detail. It's the 12th year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, who rules over the Assyrians and the great city of Nineveh. Now, anybody in the ancient world would know that this is super problematic, because Nebuchadnezzar is not the king of the Assyrians in the ancient world. He is not the king of Nineveh, which was an ancient Assyrian city. He is the king of Babylonia. So already, this does not make sense. This is like me saying, oh, George Washington, ruler of the Ukraine, doesn't make sense. And everybody would know that that does not make sense. So already, the author is not stupid. The author is not making a terrible mistake. The author is signaling something to us. Now we're told Nebuchadnezzar goes on a campaign. He's, you know, he's conquering all these lands, and he's telling his vassal city-states to join him in his expeditions, in his conquests. And Judea says no. Judea says, we are not going to join you in war. And Nebuchadnezzar becomes furious and says, you're not going to join me in war. The whole point of a city-state is you better join with me when I need you, or else I attack you, plus pay me a lot of taxes. So Nebuchadnezzar says, you know what, Judea, if you're going to not go out with me to war, I'm going to attack you. And this is the premise of the book. This is the crisis of the book, that Nebuchadnezzar goes out to Judea, to one particular town, to attack it. And Judith saves the day by seducing and executing the enemy general Holofernes. That's the story. Now, there is a passage here in the middle of chapter 2 that I did not include in the source sheet, but you could look it up easily online. But in the middle of Judith chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar assigns the job of attacking Judea and one particular town called Betulia. He assigns the job to an individual named Holofernes. This is going to be the main enemy character of the story, and this is the figure who is killed by Judith. Now, why is this important? Because what language is the name Holofernes? Is that Assyrian? Is that Babylonian? No, it's obviously Greek, right? Holofernes is a Greek name. There were no Assyrians or Babylonians using the name Holofernes in earlier times. And so you have a Babylonian king with an Assyrian empire sending his Greek general to attack a Judean town. This is ahistorical. The writer is not stupid. The writer is saying, pay attention, not to the historical details of my story, but to the theological message of my story. So the historical details are transcendent, but the message is what you need to focus on. Okay, so who do they attack? They attack a little town. This is not on the source sheet. They attack a little town called Betulia. Now, if you know even a little bit of Hebrew, you will know that Betulia means town of the virgins or virgin town. There is no evidence of such a town named Betulia in ancient Judea. So now, again, you have a Babylonian king of an Assyrian empire with a Greek general attacking virgin town. This is satirical. And I think it's satirical because it would have been dangerous in the second half of the second century BC to write an actual text that bashed the Greeks. And the Greeks are horrible. The Greeks are terrible. Here's why we hate them. Here's how we defeated them. That would be very destabilizing and risky. But it's not risky to write a book that makes no historical sense, but conveys the same message: God protects us through his pious servants. And that message comes out loud and clear. So the premise of the story is ahistorical. But what is very interesting is when you get to the middle of the work, and Judith is introduced after 7 chapters of building up the crisis, and in ancient Jewish narrative, as the crisis builds, the action slows down to increase the suspense. And so you have 7 or 8 chapters of just increasing suspense. And finally in chapter 8, Judith shows up. By the time Judith shows up, the people of Betulia are under siege. They're under siege and they're starving and they're in a panic because Holofernes is about to invade, right? The siege serves a purpose of starving out the people. They become so weak that they can't fight back when the invasion occurs. The elders of Betulia are telling the Judeans to trust in God, to have a 3-day fast, and God is going to somehow manifest himself and save the people miraculously. And Judah says, this is absolutely unacceptable. You cannot just sit around and wait for God to enact a miracle. And so you see at the end of chapter 7 that everyone is gathering around the elder, primarily Uzziah and the other rulers. And they're fighting against Uzziah, and they're saying, you know, you're just telling us to wait for salvation, but salvation isn't coming. What are we going to do? Salvation isn't coming. And Uzziah says, come on, guys, just chill out. God is going to save us. Courage, my brothers and sisters. Let us hold out for 5 more days. By that time, the Lord our God will turn his mercy to us again. He will not forsake us. all you have to do is do nothing but trust in God. Salvation will come. And they're just miserable. Everyone is starving and everyone is saying, you know, what's going to happen to us? We don't see a salvation on the horizon. This is the setting in which Judith is introduced into the crisis at the beginning of chapter 8. We're finally introduced to her. She is not mentioned earlier in the whole first half of the book. She is absent from the book. But in chapter 8, we're introduced to Judith, and we're introduced to her with some mysterious and strange details. First of all, we're told that she's a widow. Why does that matter? Because in the ancient world, if you are a single woman, you live with your father, right? If you're a married woman, you live with your spouse, your husband, and you answer to them. You're financially dependent on them. You need them. The only real independent woman would be a wealthy widow in the ancient world, in the sense that she's not answering to a spouse or a father, and she has a certain degree of mobility. And we're going to see that that mobility is really key to Judith's success, because she leaves the camp, and it's under siege, so you might be wondering how she does that, but she does it, and she goes to Holofernes' tent and kills him. So she's a widow. This is an important detail. And she mourns in a very pious way for her husband. She fasts all the days of her widowhood, except for Shabbat and Erev Shabbat, except for the holidays and the eve of those holidays. But she's always fasting because she is in mourning, but also because she has no need for such material indulgence. And yet, she's very beautiful in appearance. She's lovely to behold. And in the ancient world, it's important to keep in mind, there is no tension between beauty and piety. Whereas I think in today, especially in modern Western society, we have a stereotype of the blonde bimbo, or if you're very, very attractive, then you're probably not very smart. Or if you're very smart, then you look a little nerdy. But in the ancient world, and if you think about what the Greeks valued, the mastering of philosophy and knowledge, and also the perfection of the body, these things go hand in hand. And so this is a Judean text written in Hebrew by a pious Judean who is influenced by this Hellenistic idea that perfection of the body and perfection of the soul and the mind go together. And so the fact that she's beautiful is only an asset. And it also derives from other figures who are very popular in the Second Temple period, and we'll talk about one of them next week, Daniel and Joseph. These are diasporan heroes who are not only maximally pious, but also very attractive. Again, an asset, not a deterrent. And these are going to be, these aspects of her beauty are going to be literally her weaponry. Okay, so when she hears what's going on and that all the people are desperate and starving and Uzziah is telling them just to sit tight and wait for God, she sends her maid, who is not named in the story, by the way, and this is a very neutered translation of slave, the Hebrew's doulos, which means slave. So the English translations have maid, but that's just there to make us feel good. This is a woman's slave. So she's in charge of all she possessed. Some slaves in the ancient world had mobility and had, you know, kept the books or whatever. And so she summons the elders. And remember, Judges 4 and 5, Judith is a combination of Yael and Deborah, Devorah. And remember in the beginning of Judges 4, Deborah summons Barak. She sits there and she says, Barak is not being a good leader when it comes to defeating our enemies. Bring him to me. And Barak comes to her and he's like, I don't want to go to war unless you come with me. And then she's like, all right, I'll come with you. So this is definitely borrowed from that scene. She summons the elders, and that's a sign of power. When you go to someone else, you're the one who is recognizing the power of the individual. So she is clearly very revered. She's very communally respected. She summons the elders and they come to her and she says, all right, you clowns, listen to me, rulers of the people of Betulia. Remember, this is not a town that likely existed, but listen to the message. That's what's most important. What have you said, or what you have said to the people today is not right. You've sworn and pronounced this oath between you and God, right? You're testing God. Who are you to put God to the test, right? You're fasting and you're just waiting for like miraculous things to plop down from the heavens. You don't do that. You don't manipulate God. You're putting the Lord Almighty to the test. You will never learn anything. You cannot plumb the depths of the human heart or understand the workings of the human mind. By the way, I view this as very Hellenistic. Again, this is a Hebrew text written in Judea. That is like a typically Stoic line. So these cultural influences cross geography and they cross language. How do you expect to search out God who made all these things? Come on, you gotta take this into your own hands. And they're totally terrified of her. They're like, oh, okay, so what are you going to do? This is not in the source sheet, but if you look it up yourself, she says, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do. But now that you've basically failed at your position of leadership, I'm going to take over, step aside. It's my turn now. And what she does in chapter 9 is she prepares. And again, you can imagine how Judah Maccabee prepares in 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees by putting on all of his weaponry. She prepares by, well, some of it's in chapter 10. She prepares by making herself very, very, very beautiful. Nobody knows what she's going to do. So even the reader is meant to be full of confusion and suspense. Like, what? She's supposed to save the people, but she's going into her closet and trying on dresses. Like, come on, Judith, like, get out there. I don't care if you're wearing a denim skirt or, you know, whatever. Okay. So she removes the sackcloth because remember she'd been mourning. She bathes, she combs her hair, she puts on a tiara, she dresses herself in the festive attire that she used to wear when her husband was living. She puts sandals on her feet. Now this is so great. Why do we need all this detail? It is totally unnecessary. First of all, it slows down the action and it increases the suspense, right? Oh, I forgot my second thought, just fell out of my head. It'll probably come back to me later. Okay, so she's getting ready. This is the thought. This is also very titillating, right? Like, we're supposed to imagine her getting dressed in a way that Greek literature also would write about attractive women. And so what I think is happening here is that this story is totally cloaked in piety. This is a story about a perfectly pious woman who's totally devoted to God. And yet you're allowed to imagine this beautiful woman doing these preparations. And so I think what we have here is something that is both Jewish and pietistic, but also quite Hellenistic. There are parallel scenes in Hellenistic plays, for example, of women preparing themselves in various ways. So it's like a kosher way of sort of thinking about, you know, oh, wow, she's very beautiful. I'm allowed to think about that for a second. So she makes herself very beautiful to entice the eyes of all the men who might see her, not just Holofernes. That becomes significant later. And then she gives her slave, I'm not going to say maid, because I don't think that that's a fair translation to the sad slave, who really saves the day and doesn't get much credit. So she she gives her maid a skin of wine, so like a flask, like a bag of wine, a flask of oil filled with grain, dried fig cakes. Why? Because she keeps kosher. She keeps the dietary laws, and she's about to go into the enemy camp and seduce Holofernes, and she doesn't know how long she's going to be there, and she needs to bring her kosher food. And so how does she get out of the siege? And by the way, don't stress that we're not getting to the other texts. We'll get to what we get to and everything else you could read on your own. So what does she do? Her town is under siege. How is she going to get to the enemy camp that's at the foot of the mountain? Betulia, imagine Betulia is on a hill and the Judeans are at the top of the hill and the enemy is camped at the foot of this hill. And so she walks out of the gates of the town. She knows that the enemy is somewhere lower towards the bottom of the hill. And she says to the elders, order the gate of the town to be open for me so that I may go out and accomplish the things you have just said to me. And they're like, okay, Judith. And she walks out of the town gates accompanied by her slave. And the men of the town are totally ogling her. The men of the town watch her like, as she goes down the mountain and passes through the valley where they lose sight of her, literally just staring, can't stop looking at her. And she's like, whatever. I imagine her as the Angelina Jolie of the ancient world, like the Lara Croft. She gets to the Assyrian patrol and, you know, in normal circumstances, they would probably kill her or maybe take her as an enemy, as a captive. And they say, to what people do you belong? Where are you coming from? Where are you going? They're totally like googly eyed. And she's like, hello, I'm a daughter of the Hebrews. I'm fleeing from them because they're about to be handed over to you. So I'm switching sides. I'm on my way to see Holofernes, the commander of your army, to give him a true report. I'm a spy. I'm no longer loyal to my people of Judea. Let me out. And they're like, okay, like that makes a lot of sense. Your story holds water. I mean, totally doesn't. Your story holds water. Sure. You know, they observe her face. She was in their eyes marvelously beautiful. And they said, you've saved your life by hurrying down to see our Lord. Go to his tent. Like, just go. Like, let's make our main leader totally vulnerable. And they're marveling at her beauty and they admire the Israelites. Now, this is satirical. They're supposed to look dumb and silly. They say to one another, who can despise these people who have women like this among them? It's not wise to leave one of their men alive, for if we let them go, they'll beguile the whole world. They're supposed to be a bunch of bumbling fools. Oh, look, this woman looks very nice. Let's let her into the tent of the enemy of our general. And let's, you know, just make ourselves completely vulnerable in that way. It's silly. Now, she becomes very friendly with Holofernes, and she doesn't kill him right away. They have 3 days together where she seduces him, essentially. And he is so in awe of her that he lets her eat using her own silver dinnerware. I mean, this is incredible because this is one of the earliest attestations to strict dietary law in a way that is not founded in the biblical text. But you can see there's already an oral tradition of like intricate dietary laws. So she's not eating with them. She has her own stuff. And Holofernes is like, yeah, you know, I totally respect every single ancestral law by which you are abiding. If your supply runs out, where can you get more of the same? For none of, like, he's stressing about halacha. Like, for none of your people are here with us. Like, where are you going to do? There's no like kosher section of Jewel. That's the kosher store in Chicago. And she's like, don't worry, I'm good, my lord. Like, thanks so much for worrying about my like halachic commitments. I'm good. And so after 3 days, he's totally taken with her. They haven't slept together, but he's, you know, falling in love, let's say. And she creates a schedule that he gets accustomed to where she comes and goes. She comes and goes to pray. So she walks out of the tent a little bit outside of the enemy camp to pray and to eat. And so he's used to her coming and going until she has him sort of like a Pavlovian dog, like accustomed to her mobility. And then he's like, you know what, guys, we really need to seduce her, because if we don't, she's going to laugh at us. And again, this is silly, right? Like, as you know, from a female perspective, like, this is totally bananas. But okay, it would be a disgrace if we let such a woman go without sleeping with her. If we do not seduce her, she'll laugh at us. And they're like, okay, we need to just, you know, seduce her. Great. So Holofernes approaches her with this proposition. And she says, again, totally satirically, because she thinks that they're, you know, cuckoo. Judith says, who am I to refuse my lord? Whatever pleases him, I'll do at once. It'll be a joy to me until the day of my death. And of course, this is ironic because she's planning on murdering him, and that will be a joy to her until the day of her death, because she will forever be known as the woman who killed the enemy general and saved the Jewish people. And then again, when he says, come dine with me, she says, I will gladly drink, my lord, because today is the greatest day in my whole life. And he's like, wow, I am so flattered. She thinks that this is the greatest day of her life, but of course, it is the greatest day in her life. For a very different reason, she's planning on beheading him. And so we have incredible entertainment value in the story, because the reader knows what Judith knows, which is that Judith has a plan. The only one who doesn't know this plan is Holofernes and his goons. And so this is incredibly entertaining and yet totally pietistic. We are with the heroine the whole way, and she never violates her ancestral laws. She never even sleeps with him. She does not undermine her integrity at all. And yet it's so, so entertaining. And this is like the best of Hellenistic Jewish literature. And yes, I call it Hellenistic, even though I'm the first to say this text was written in Hebrew in Judea. Nevertheless, this is a Hellenistic text, and it was circulated in both Hebrew and Greek in both Judea and the diaspora. This is a text that borrows from biblical themes, specifically Judges 4 and 5, but also Hellenistic themes. And so we move on. So she goes to his bed, and like the big moment is about to come, and she goes up to the bedpost, and already he's like very, now here we have the tradition from Hanukkah and sort of overlapping with the Yael story of how she gives the enemy Sisera milk and he gets sleepy. But so he falls asleep and he's totally conked out. And then, wait a second. So what happens here? They end up not sleeping together, because he falls asleep. They're all weary. The banquet had lasted so long. Okay. And then she goes up to the bedpost near Holofernes' head, takes the sword that hung there. Now, if you are interested in Christian medieval art, there are incredible representations of this scene of Judith executing Holofernes. You could look it up. Some really fun stuff out there. She comes to his bed. She takes a hold of his hair and says, give me strength today, because she's pious. She never breaks from her focus, Judith. It's all about devotion to God and her people. And yet there's this like titillating aspect of it that allows us to sort of like in a maybe not totally kosher way, imagine these scenes. Give me strength today, O Lord God of Israel. And then she struck his neck twice with all her might and cut off his head. And this, there's some great detail here, so I have to share it with you. She rolled his body off the bed, pulled it down the canopy from the post, and then she goes out and she gave Holofernes' head to her slave, who places it in a food bag. What? Slave lady who's not named? What are you doing taking his bloody head and sticking it in the food bag? Okay, I love this. I love this detail. So the way that I read this is that, okay, she rolls his body off the bed and then pulls down the sheets from the four-post bed. I think then what it isn't saying here, but what I think happens is, so she has the sheet, she has the head, she wraps the head up in the sheet and then sticks it in the food bag. Otherwise, like, her grilled fish is like very much not kosher. I can't imagine like mixing up with her food. So I think that she wraps the head in the sheet and then puts it in the food bag. For some reason, this feels like an important detail to me. Sorry, I'm getting a text message on my computer. It feels like an important detail to me, because otherwise, like, that's disgusting. Anyway, so she goes back to Betulia. Salvation has been effected. She goes back and she calls to the elders, open the gate. God, our God, is with us, still showing his power and Israel and his strength against our enemies as he has done today. And the people are just overjoyed. The rest of the enemy camp, once they realize that Holofernes is dead, they escape. And she sings, it's not in the Surah sheet, but she sings a beautiful song that imitates the song of Devorah in Judges chapter 5, Shoftim Hay. And thus the people are saved. So again, you know, what is the point of this book? I think, first of all, you can't separate the ways in which the author is dependent on biblical tradition and the ways in which the author is dependent on the cultural milieu, the Hellenistic cultural milieu around him. And so there are aspects here that are very Hellenistic, and there are aspects here that are clearly biblical. What's most important is that Judith never breaks her focus on doing this for the sake of her people and her God. She is pious till the end. The fact that the story is ahistorical, by which I mean that the historical details simply don't work, is intentional. But I do think that this is a satirical text, a polemic against the Syrian Greeks, whom Judah and his brothers had defeated between 175 and 164. But it would be risky and dangerous to write an anti-Greek text in the middle or late second century BC. And so we have a non or ahistorical text that I think is clearly a polemic against the Greeks. And ironically, using Hellenistic stylistics to articulate that polemic against the Greeks. Okay, I do see that there are some comments, but I'm not reading them right now. So if you could maybe save them, I'm gonna try to wrap up in maybe 10 minutes. But we've only talked about one text, and I really wanna talk about the Greek version of Esther. The fact is that many of you know about this Greek version. The older Hebrew version of Esther, is hard to date, and I'm not going to bother trying to date it. And I'm also not going to delve into the many challenges of Hebrew Esther, because these are very well known. No God, no prayer, no reference to ancestral tradition, and two other very big problems that people don't think of. One is the happy ending of Hebrew Esther is intermarriage. Esther and Ahasuerus walk off into the sunset, and that's the happy ending. Right? We all talk about, oh my gosh, there's no God in Esther. Whoa, how could this be in the Tanakh? How could it be in the Tanakh? The happy ending of this book is intermarriage. That to me is a bigger problem. But also it centers the Jewish people and their existential survival and their success squarely in the diaspora. And I think that that's a problem too for Judeans who are reading this story and saying, wait a second, the fate, the existential fate of Israel, it doesn't lie in the diaspora, it lies in Judea. Greek Esther comes to address these issues. There are six editions in the Greek version of Esther that become preserved in the Apocrypha. And these editions include God, God, God is everywhere. God is running the show. There are miracles. There is prayer. There are references to some ancestral law. There are six editions. And if I had more time, I would love to tell you these editions, like really go through them in detail, because they're fascinating and a lot of fun to read. The first edition is very Hellenistic. Mordechai has a dream. It's interpreted in the last edition, in edition F. This dream is very Hellenistic. Again, we're in Greek Esther now. This is the Greek version of Esther. In the dream, Mordechai sees two battling dragons, and one defeats the other, and he doesn't know what it means. Of course, this dream totally foreshadows the whole story. It's meant as a literary technique to tell us exactly how the story is going to go. Noises and confusion, thunder and earthquake, tumult on the earth. Two dragons come forward, again, very Hellenistic. And they roar terribly. At their roaring, every nation prepares for war. Anyway, he like wakes up in a sweat. He's like, what does this mean? And then in the final edition, he's like, I get it now. Israel was the victorious dragon and the other nations were the non-victorious dragon. So it just sets the stage in a very Hellenistic and yet pietistic way. The second edition and the second to last edition are the letters of the king that in the first case insist on the genocide of the Jewish people. And in the second case, repeal the edict of genocide. So it's the content of the letters that we don't have in Hebrew Esther. And the middle sections are prayers at the pinnacle of the crisis that Esther and Mordechai utter, because there are no prayers in the Hebrew version. Okay, but I'm not going to really pay attention to any of this, although I really encourage you to look at these on your own. I do ask, if you've joined late, that you please mute. Please mute. You know what? I'm just gonna mute again. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so I'm not going to draw your attention to what's extremely intriguing, and I encourage you to read on your own, the dreams of Mordechai, the interpretation of the dream at the end of Greek Esther, and the prayers of Esther Mordechai. All of this serves to both read like a more Hellenistic story and also read like a more pietistic story. But what I want to pay attention to with our limited time is the conclusion of Greek Esther, which does not appear in Hebrew Esther. Hebrew Esther has a very sort of anticlimactic ending. The happy ending of Greek Esther is intermarriage, which we don't seem to usually be bothered about. And then guess what? Ahasuerus enacted a tax. Isn't that fantastic and super interesting? Like, we end this very dramatic story with taxes. It just seems anticlimactic. Although taxes are a sign of health and success, but still anticlimactic. The Greek version of Esther ends with a couple lines that are absolutely intriguing, and you might sort of skip over it and ignore it. But I think that understanding this conclusion, what's called the colophon of Greek Esther, is really the key to understanding the book as a whole. And this is what it says. In the fourth year of the reign of Ptolemy and Cleopatra, and there were a few Ptolemy and Cleopatra brother, sister, king, queens of Egypt. So it's unclear when we could date this, but I would say early first century BCE, maybe 77, 76 BCE. Dositheus, Greek name of a Jew living in Judea, because remember, there are no clear geographic binaries when it comes to these cultural influences. So we have a Greek, we have a pious Jew in Judea with a Greek name, okay? So in the fourth year of the reign of Ptolemy and Cleopatra, Dositheus, who said he was a priest and a Levite, and Ptolemy, his son, brought to Egypt this epistole, this epistle. So the whole text of Greek Esther brought this text concerning the Furei, I would say the Purim, saying that it was authentic and that Lysimachus, the son of Ptolemy, a resident of Jerusalem, had translated it. Now, why is this so important? It seems like pretty boring historical detail about the nature in which this text was produced, but it's actually very, very important to understanding the story, because what this colophon does is it transforms Greek Esther into a Judean text. Now, we often think of Greek Esther as the Greek version, the diasporan version of the story that was produced by diasporan Jews for diasporan Jews, totally outside of the Hebrew version, which was circulated and read in Judea. That's simply not the case. In fact, if you compare Hebrew Esther with Greek Esther, Hebrew Esther seems much more oriented to the diaspora. The prayers of Mordechai and Esther in Greek Esther allude to the temple. It's more centered in Judea. And this colophon tells us something that actually we don't know about Hebrew Esther, which is that it was produced in Jerusalem by priests and Levites, leaders of the Judean community. Produced, now we don't know if they produced all six editions. Some scholars say that a few of the editions were actually produced after it was sent to Egypt based on linguistic analyses of those editions. But we know that the skeleton, the bones of Greek Esther was produced by Judean Jews in Jerusalem for the purpose of being disseminated to the diaspora. And to me, this is very fascinating because it sort of undermines the diasporan focus of the story. It says, well, yes, this is a story of how the Jews in the diaspora were saved, but it's authorized and legitimized by the leaders of the Jewish people who are in Jerusalem. So I think this is a very fascinating historical nugget. And it makes me think that Greek Esther and Judith come from similar milieus, second century BCE, Judea. Yes, Judith was clearly originally written in Hebrew. Almost no scholars disagree with that, but it soon circulated in Greek in the diaspora. And so we have Greek Esther and Judith, very similar stories, very similar narrative arcs coming from the same environment in the second half of the second century BCE. So why was Judith not canonized? Well, that I think is simply a very boring answer. People ask me all the time, but I think the boring answer is it's late. It was produced in the second half of the second century. It's circulated in Greek. There aren't, you know, unless you maybe date the second half of Daniel to very, very late, which some academics do, there really aren't texts in the biblical canon, in the Tanakh, that are written this late. So Judith is not preserved in the Tanakh, but I would call Judith a very, very pietistic text. I don't know how much more I want to do, being that it's 10:45. I want to briefly introduce 3 Maccabees to you. It doesn't have anything to do with the books of Maccabees 1 and 2, which we'll talk about, I think, in 2 weeks. So it doesn't have anything to do with the story of the Maccabees. But I think the author had 2 Maccabees because there's overlapping language. But the story is not about the Maccabees. The story, some have called it the diasporan version of Esther, because the story is about a crisis of Alexandrian Jewry. Ptolemy the king wants to enter the Jerusalem temple. He is rebuffed by the high priest, and he takes his rage out against the Alexandrian Jews when he comes back home to Alexandria. And he says, I'm going to kill all the Jews who are miraculously saved. If you compare 3 Maccabees to Esther, whether it's Hebrew Esther or Greek Esther, you will see narrative parallels between these stories in a way that suggests, although I'm not totally convinced, that the author is carefully attentive to the story of Esther and wants to make a diasporan version, not an Eastern diasporan version where it takes place in Persia, but a Western diasporan version that takes place in Alexandria that would speak to Jews. There are about 1 million Jews, remember, living in Egypt at this time, or maybe less, but certainly hundreds of thousands of Jews. And so he wanted to produce a story that had a similar narrative arc, but a resonance that was particular to the experience of the diaspora. And so I would invite you on your own to read the story, note the parallels with Esther, and note the sort of crisis salvation motifs. The one thing I would say about 3 Maccabees is that it does not have a female heroine. It doesn't. The reason why, I cannot say, but it does not have a female heroine. It doesn't even have a male heroine. It has pious leaders such as Eleazar and Simon the high priest, but these figures are not the protagonists, are not followed all the way through. So it does not feature a female heroine. I cannot tell you that I have a satisfactory answer as to why that is the case. If you're interested in other novellas, I would suggest that you look at the second century BCE Alexandrian Greek text known as Joseph and Asenath, which talks about Asenath, the wife of Joseph, and her story of what you might call conversion to Israelite religion. This has nothing to do with crisis and salvation. It's just a lovely tale of love between 2 individuals and addressing a biblical problem, which is how could Joseph have married outside of his own Abrahamic covenantal community? And comes this text and says, no, she piously and genuinely converted. Although, of course, conversion is a difficult word to use when we're talking about the ancient world, because there wasn't a systematic rabbinic conversion at this early stage. But it's a lovely and entertaining novella produced in Alexandria, circulating in Greek. Finally, Tobit is another text. By the way, Joseph and Asenath is not preserved in the Apocrypha. Tobit is another adventure tale. This is an earlier text, late 3rd century BCE, written in Hebrew, definitely, I think, Judean. Again, you know, I'm not going to tell you the whole story now, but what I want you to know is that there is a genre here. And the genre of novellas is extraordinarily popular because it allows Jews, whether they're in the diaspora or in Judea, whether they're writing in Greek or they're writing in Hebrew, it allows Jews to explore pertinent questions of identity without taking major political risks, right? Because you could have a fictional king who is really evil and really wants to annihilate all the Jews. And as long as you're not naming the particular king who's living in your own time, you're pretty safe. Right, but if you're going to write a history of Antiochus IV Epiphanes and what he did to your family and how he killed, God forbid, you know, how he killed your neighbors and your children or whatever horrible thing he did, then you're setting yourself up for you know, extreme risk. And so the novellas that are produced at this time address major questions of Jewish identity. Many of them argue you can learn from the Hellenistic world, but you must understand that your Jewish ancestral tradition always takes precedent and is always superior culturally, theologically, to the Hellenistic world in which we live. Okay. So with that, I'm going to look, you know, I see the questions. I do feel bad because I can't necessarily read all of these right now, but I did put my email in, I did put my email into the chat. You know, I know all the parallels between Judith and Devorah and Yael. That is not the nature of today's class, but, you know, it's definitely very interesting for another shiur. Lots and lots of parallels there. I think what I would invite you to do now is, you know, I'm going to try to answer a couple of these questions and then you can stay on to ask questions because I'm not going to address all these now, but I see a very easy one. Where is Joseph and Asenath found? So in the first class, we talked about the collection of the pseudepigrapha. And the pseudepigrapha is a collection that derives from the late 18th century when Johann Fabricius, who is a German Protestant scholar, goes to ancient libraries and monasteries and starts collecting ancient texts that were not canonized. And this collection has grown and grown and grown and grown over the past two centuries or three. And so today we would say that Joseph and Asenath is preserved in the pseudepigrapha. We have many, many, many medieval manuscripts of this document. And the fact that we have many medieval manuscripts of it in different languages tells us it was probably extraordinarily popular. Do you need to be wealthy to write these texts, or were there patrons who supported the less wealthy? That's a fascinating question. I don't know, I can't tell you like the exact socioeconomic circumstances of each author, but I could tell you the fact that they know how to use not only earlier scriptural texts, but also Hellenistic ideas that are circulating among Stoics tells me that they're well educated in Hellenistic thinking for the most part, even Judith. And there are lots of scholarship on how these texts use Hellenistic thinking and even Hellenistic texts. So I could go much more into detail. If you want to email me, I could give you readings on this. But it seems to me that if you are highly educated in the ancient world, you are economically privileged. Was Esther ever meant to be taken as a Greek version of Esther while slipping in motifs to conform to Judean ideals? Was it meant to be taken as truth? I'm not going to get into the question of truth now because I don't think that Jews in the second century read texts the way that we read them today, like so associating the value of a text according to its level of veracity. I don't know that they were worried about every detail being truthful. That's not what they read for. I think that they read for message, not for historical archive. At this time, I'm going to invite you to call out a question. I see some people are starting to leave. I know that there's a class coming up in 7 minutes and I wanna be able to give you the time that you need to get a cup of coffee or whatever, but feel free. I don't know if I can, I think I can unmute you, or can you unmute yourselves?
Could you tell us about the text? Why does the Megillat Esther end with text? You said it's something to do with Greek.
I think it's very innocuous. Why does the Hebrew version of Esther end with a text? I think that that's a sign. I think that that's a compliment to the ways in which Mordechai and Esther contributed towards the health of the overall kingdom and represented by the permissiveness of allowing the Jews to live as they want to live rather than threatening the health of that kingdom, as Haman claims. I think it contributes to the health of the kingdom. So I think it sounds sort of like a boring detail to us, but if the accusation of Haman is the accusation that we're seeing over and over in anti-Jewish writings at this time, which we are, there are lots of anti-Jewish writings in the late Second Temple period that Jews destabilize and threaten the wealth of the government, then I think that this tax detail actually serves as a polemic against that anti-Jewish threat.
Thank you.
Lahavdil, like Donald Trump, was very good for the economy.
Oh, great. You know, I'm a little tempted to get into politics, but, you know, I'll just say yes, thank you. Oh, the next class is at 12:15. Okay, so you have some time. Yes, did you have a question?
Yeah, first, with reference to tax, couldn't you say that this way Ahasuerus wouldn't be tempted to bribes of 10,000 silver, whatever, the shekels, like, of Haman to kill the Jews? That way you have a regular source of income and you don't have,
That's a great reading. That's interesting. I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, I think David Dowie said it, I believe. I had a question about, could Judith be a critique of Hasidic quietism in favor of Maccabean activism?
Yes, absolutely. So what you're referring to, this is Professor Kaplan, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so what Professor Kaplan is referring to is that in 1 Maccabees, and also alluded to in 2 Maccabees, is that they're Hasidians, Hasidim. We don't know, don't compare them to 18th century Hasidim, but we don't know a lot about them. They're probably an early sect, and they refuse to pick up arms on the Sabbath and fight against the Syrian Greeks. And Judah Maccabee says, no, absolutely not. I don't believe in martyrdom. I think that, you know, even on the Sabbath, we could violate the Sabbath to save lives. What's interesting about that conflict is that what is clear in rabbinic, in later rabbinic law, is an open halachic debate in the Second Temple period, where in the second century BC, Jews are still talking about this. To what extent do you keep the Sabbath? Can you violate it under certain circumstances? Later, the rabbis say, yes, 100%, you have to violate the Sabbath. But at this early stage, it's still an open debate. The Hasidim say, no, absolutely not. We will die rather than violate the Sabbath. And Judah Maccabee says no. And Judith says no. And this supports my theory, actually, that I think Judith is a symbolic stand-in for Judah. You know, whether all readers of the text were reading it that way, I don't know. But I do think that that's what we're seeing. And I think you're absolutely right to point out that parallel.
Did these start out life as a written document, or were they originally oral stories that later got written down?
Yeah, I think that that's a great question. And I think this varies from text to text. So next week, I think we're going to look at the Daniel stories. It's clear that these stories are circulating orally before they're written down, because we have various iterations of them. And I'll talk more about that next week. But it seems that the Daniel stories are circulated orally and written down, maybe not later, but simultaneously. These questions are, you know, very messy, because we don't have the manuscriptal evidence to really know for sure. When it comes to some of these texts, however, I do think that they came to life on the page. So for example, you know, I think whether or not there's a kernel of historical truth that Judith is based on, I think the text as we have it was written down. And the reason why I think that is because I think that Judges 4 and 5, Shoftim, Dal, and Neher, are so incredibly foundational to this book. Now, again, there could have been a historical kernel that, you know, something happened that sort of undergirds this story that is no longer historical. And I'm not denying the possibility or even the likelihood of that. But I think the book as we have it, I think really wasn't necessarily circulating orally, if that makes sense. So I think it really depends on the text that you're dealing with.
I have a question on that.
You know what? I'm going to take Gerald, and then we're going to take, I don't know who, there was one woman.
Casey.
And then we're going to wrap up. So Gerald and then Casey.
Okay. Question. As far as the additions are concerned to Esther, that's a rather unusual phenomenon that there should be additions floating around as opposed to complete books. Could it not be that there were two editions of Esther working in parallel with each other, and that these are not additions, but actually excisions?
So that's, you know, that's a question. I think you might be interested in Elias Bickerman's work on this, because he asked some of those questions. You know, I think the bigger question is, and also Aaron Kohler has a really nice book on Esther that addresses some of these questions. Can I say for sure? No, I can't say anything for sure. The scholarly consensus is that this book was expanded with some of these additions, but based on the nature of the Greek in, I believe it's the Edict of the King in the second and the second to last editions, those come later. So that's the scholarly consensus. You know, there is some diversion. And again, I could recommend Bickerman's work on this too. I personally cannot tell you that I'm compelled either way.
You may have just answered my question, but I was wondering, why was the Hebrew Esther canonized, but not the Greek Esther?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so that's a really fundamental question that is very, very hard. But look, you know, sometimes the best answers are boring answers. And I think that that Hebrew Esther is early. It's written in Hebrew. It had profound resonance for the Jewish people, both in Judea and the diaspora. You're not going to canonize a work that's circulating in Greek in the second century BCE. It's just too late. You know, even if the majority of Jews are reading their scriptures in Greek, if it's not originally written in Greek, it's not going to be a candidate. And so, yeah, I think Hebrew Esther was considered a very powerful story. And I actually love ending on this note because it's Purim in a few days. And I wish you all a wonderful, meaningful, joyous Purim in a time of darkness. It truly has been, you know, just such a challenging year. And I hope that Purim and what follows brings all of us great light. And I look forward to seeing you all next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chag Sameach.
My pleasure.
Chag Sameach.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Purim Sameach. Yeah.